Hello and welcome to Chalk Talk. Today it's Alexandra Churchill talking about the First World War.
Hello. Firstly, I'm really sorry I'm not Harriet Holman. And thank you for keeping me company, even though I'm not. I'm really excited because I've got one of these to play with. So I thought I would talk today about why it's important to preserve the human experience of World War One. Basically, everybody is gone. And I think as a generation, it falls to us to make sure that their voice doesn't go too. I think it's important to speak. I think this is our last chance to get it. Already I note that I'm no longer talking to people's nephews and nieces and grandchildren. I'm talking to their great nieces and great great nephews. And it's getting further and further away. And I think it's really important that we're not left with a sterile set of statistics. Empathy with human experience is what makes people passionate about history. And if we just wanted to review life as a set of numbers, we'd all be boring mathematicians and this festival wouldn't be nearly as much fun. So I was just going to talk through some of the projects that I've been doing over the centenary and how myself and my researchers that I work with, who are friends, pick the stories and to share some of the stories with you and talk about how we found them. So the first thing that I did was a book about Eton College and the First World War. This came about because of this young man who was captain of the school as late as 1916, and he lived quite locally to where he lived in Chipstead. So it was quite easy to sort of go to where he lived and see his house and see him on a war memorial and things like that. And I went down to Eton and stupidly started finding all of this other really interesting stuff as I was reading about him and writing it all down. And this meant that I had piles and piles and piles of research, which I hope one day to put into a new role of honour for Eton, because one thing that they didn't do as a school was, so Harrow and Winchester will have volumes and volumes describing all of their war dead, and they'll tell you who they were, where they came from, and what happened to them and how they died. Eton don't have that. They got something that was equally as ambitious, but it's basically a war list. So as well as detailing people who had died, the master that put it together, he detailed everyone who served. So he managed to compile information on 5,500 in excess of old boys. And most of these scattered after the end of the war, as you'd expect. And he managed to run them all down and find out where they'd fought and what they'd done and what medals they'd been awarded. So it's not like they didn't care, but they didn't have anything like this. And then I was doing a television appearance. It's called World War One Tunnels of Death, that the Americans picked the title for. And we wanted to call it The Big Dig, but we had to shut up because they put loads of money into it. So I was doing that, and a publisher called me and said, if you were going to write a book, what would you write about? And I said, well, I've got all of these stories of these public schoolboys that went to Eton, and some of them are amazing, and they are so far in excess of anything that you could put into a role of honour, that I really think you could tell the whole story of the war through the eyes of Eton. And I wanted to combat sort of this image of Hugh Laurie and Blackadder of all the junior officers being idiots, because they really weren't. And also as well, because they're so young and some of the stuff they did is so incredible. And I just wanted to tell the stories. So they went done and gave me a really little contract to write a book, because I don't think they were even convinced I'd actually do it. But I had a few stories in mind that I was definitely going to build the book around. So at the end of the book, there's a group of friends who all leave school as late as 1915 and 16 and are in the Guards at the end of the war. But I wanted to share a story of two brothers with you that were immediately, as soon as they said, what would you write about, they were in the book proposal. And I knew that I would build a fair bit of 1914 and 15 around them. And it all started because there's a flag hanging in the antechapel at Eton, and it's disgusting. It's barely coloured. You can just about make out that it was French. And it's got lots of little holes ripped in it. And it's got some initials next to it on the wall. And actually, they're the wrong initials. But it said whose it was. So I thought, well, I'm going to run this down. And I ran it down to a classics teacher at the school who actually was an old boy as well. And his name is George Fletcher. He's actually Walter George Fletcher, and that's why the initials were all crossed about. But it turned out that on one night when he was bored on the Western Front, he decided that he was going to run across no man's land, crawl through the dirt, and nick this French flag that the Germans were hanging over their trench, because they were mocking them with it. And he taught in Germany, so he was fluent in German, and there was a lot of banter going backwards and forwards across. They weren't really trenches. They were in such wet ground that they were kind of parapets built up, and they would chat across the barrier. And he decided he was going to go and get it, run it back and run it up their flagpole, and then basically stick two fingers up to the Germans across when they woke up the next morning and found their flag gone. And that was the story. But as I started researching him, I was thinking, I know this name from somewhere else. And this is what immediately became apparent about Eaton, was that I had letters to Arthur, the pilot, to his mother from George's father, because his uncle and George's father had gone to Eaton together as well. And they were the best of friends. And so there were letters about George's death. I mean, he was sadly killed a few weeks after the flag incident. And they think that actually that was the Germans were a lot more alert in that sector because they'd been messing around. But his father had given the flag to Eaton, and that's why it hangs in the chapel. But I had letters from his father that I didn't even realise. So I went looking for the family as well, because that's one thing I really try to do, is I think there's still so much stuff in personal hands that people aren't looking at. I think there's a tendency, because now you can just Google a battle and find tons of stories online that people have shared online. But there's so much, you're really missing a trick if you don't try and go right to the root of the family and see what they've got. And actually what I found was that George had a hilarious brother called Reggie, I named my cat after this guy, I like him that much. He's basically Blackadder incarnate. He is sarcastic, he's funny. At one point in his diaries, he's threatening to take on, during the shell shortage, he's threatening to take on the Germans with a toothpick he's got in his pocket. And these two brothers died within 6 months of each other. And I went and met their niece. They had a third brother who served at Jutland and survived the war, and that's Leslie, the eldest brother, and that's George in their little elf outfit. But to sit with his niece, and she was telling me about how devastated, so that was it, there were three boys and two of them died in the war, going to her grandparents' house when she was little and being allowed into this shrine where they had all of George's belongings and Reggie's belongings. They had oars because Reggie rode for Oxford in the 14 boat race, which they lost, unfortunately. And they had rowing trophies from George as well, and little keepsakes like her sugar bowl. She made me a cup of tea, and her sugar bowl is a silver cup with an inscription on that's from boys at Shrewsbury School who had George as a rowing coach before he went back to teach at Eton. And she said, "Can you tell me what this is?" And I went, "Yeah, that's a house at Shrewsbury, and they've given him that as a thank you." And that, so just to be in that house and to see all these things she had in her house and see how real these people are to their families still is something I really try and capture in books. So I did the Eaton book, and then I wasn't going to do anything else. And then this came up. I've already spied one of my kind over there with his T-shirt on. But this was just utter self-indulgence. This was, I didn't care if I made not a single penny out of it. It's my football club and my war, and I wanted to do it. And talking to the sales manager, who's a West Ham fan, about the Eaton book at the launch, and he said, "All this stuff you've got on Chelsea, what are you going to do with it?" And I said, "Well, there's myself and there's about five other Chelsea fans who are also interested in World War One. We're a select group, there's only six of us." And we decided that we would love to do this. And they said that they'd had over 100 proposals for a specific football club book about World War One, and they hadn't picked any of them up. And for some reason, they picked ours. I know not why. I don't really care. I like to think it's because we're good at what we do. But this was the first time I teamed up with Andrew Holmes, who I also worked with on the Somme book and on the Passchendaele book as well. I like, and I think they liked, that our club's contribution is somewhere in the middle. We never went into it to say our football club was the greatest during World War One. More people died from Chelsea than anywhere else, and we were all over the papers, and we did everything. We're just middle of the road. It had only been in existence for 10 years. It's always been quite high profile, just like it is now, because of where it is. So it's not like they were, Arsenal at the time were tiny and no one cared. which I love as well. We beat them 1-0 in the FA Cup in 1915. That's in the book. So what we wanted to do was just show an average contribution of an average club in the football community and what it did to World War One. Our club as well, Chelsea, you're really well placed to talk about the wider impact of football in the war, which I didn't realise when we started researching it. But the Footballers' Battalion, which was effectively a PALS battalion that was created to counter this argument that football was not doing its bit in the Great War, was founded on the doorstep of Chelsea, so they were really heavily involved from the beginning. So it was a really good window to start to talk about that. But one thing that we did, it was really important for me to put these stories into context as we went along with the local community, because we were finding fans who we knew went to Chelsea before the war, who worked as costermongers on the North End Road, and who went on a Saturday after work, and who worked at wallpaper factories just up the river near Imperial Wharf and things like that. So actually, if on my walk now from the train station to the ground on a match day, I go past the roads and I can see where the fans that went before me lived, these guys that basically volunteered at the football because these recruiting cries went up and they were invited to come and serve with your heroes. And they did. So they were fighting side by side with their famous footballers of the day. But one thing that I really liked was that really quickly, all the best stories turned out to be about the fans. So it wasn't like the fans and the community were an afterthought. Straight away, they were actually the stars of the book. And there's a lot more fan groups and people who work for the club in the book than there are players. That's the crowd in 1914 at Chelsea. So when we were writing about football, and how there was a press campaign by the Daily Mail, who was sponsoring this event and are lovely, but a press campaign to make out that football was lazy and that football should be given up, and that everybody who played football should go and enlist straight away. Actually, when we put it into context and researched it, at that time, there's about 7,000 professional footballers at the time of the First World War breaking out. And most of them are married. And at that time, there's no pressure on any other married men to go and volunteer at all. And yet football is being hounded in the press because these married men aren't giving up their jobs and going to fight. And this picture was used because, as you can see, almost everyone in it, if they're not a child, is in uniform. So this was out in this programme is from one of the programmes that we saw from December 1914. It was a game we lost. We lost most games that year. I think we almost got relegated. But so that was really important to us, that it was about the fans. And just in the same way that we were doing the Eton book, we really, really wanted to make sure that we found the root of the story. So we had a programme from Chelsea that had a letter in it from a boy who was serving at the front. He was 19 years old and serving in the Irish Guards. So we thought, OK, well, this is too good to be true. We researched him and we found out he died in 1915. So straight away, we wanted to cover this kid. And we took it back to his father, William, who was a regular in the army, so it was a real army family, used to take his son Cecil to Chelsea every weekend. So it was like, at that time, it was alternating. So the first team one weekend, and then the next weekend, you'd have the reserves playing. So every Saturday, this was the thing they did together. And Cecil had written a letter back to the club to put in the programme saying, oh, we're having a whale of a time out here and we're going to show the Germans what's what. And he was killed at Festubert, but because we went and found, and we were lucky enough to find Cecil's nephew, so William's grandson, unfortunately he died just before the book came back from the printers, but he filled in all of the blanks for us. And by the time we came to write it up for the book, we realised that Cecil's not the only story with this family, because William, who had retired in 1912 after more than 20 years in the army, when Cecil is killed in 1915 at Festubert, he rejoins again and in his 50s and goes back to war. And he's at the Battle of the Somme with the South Wales Borderers, I think because possibly it was one of the only battalions that he could get into at that age. And then eventually when they bring the Labour Corps in for the less firm / older members of the army in 1917, he moved across into that. But the story was that by the time the war ended, William Dean had served nearly 40 years, because he started, I think he went in as a bugler or a drummer boy. So that was possibly the best story that we found for the Chelsea book. So see what's next. So then we thought, yay, we're getting our lives back. We did all of this in 6 months. We got this Chelsea book out, probably sold about 4 copies, but we were happy. And then this place happened. This is the Charles Holden in Colliers Wood. And too much alcohol got consumed at Christmas, and we decided, wouldn't it be great if we did a Somme book? So we sat there, several gin down, as far as I'm concerned, and beer for Andrew and Jonathan, And we decided that we wanted to write a book about the Somme. And the first thing we did was shout each other down because we absolutely did not want to get caught up in a huge wash of books. So everything was going to be republished for 2016. There were going to be a lot of new books. And we said, we're not doing this unless we've actually got something fresh to say. So we sat and we made a brief for ourselves. We said, how can you do this differently to how it's been done before and how everybody else is approaching it? Because if we can't think of a way to do it, then we're just going to go back to the gin. We didn't want to do another battle history. I love the way that I covered Eton, doing it through the eyes of individuals who fought instead of an overarching battle book. And we'd taken that through to the Chelsea book as well. And we absolutely wanted to carry that through again for the Somme. One of our beefs was how much attention everybody pays to the 1st of July. So we wanted to make sure that we had a perspective right from the beginning that we were covering a battle that lasted for more than 3 months. And that whilst paying due diligence to the 1st of July, we were absolutely not going to write half a book about that and then just cram everything else in. And we had to think about what our strengths were, which are obviously personal stories. And rather than sort of intricate battle analysis, we got really good doing the Chelsea book of taking one day or one battle, one small battle, and doing it from one person's perspective. So what we came up with in the end was a process by which we wanted to do 141 entries, because there's 141 days in the Battle of the Somme, and we wanted to tell the story of the battle through the eyes of one man who died on each day. Or man/woman, there is one woman in the Somme book as well. So the narrative was going to be carried through by these men that died. At the time, we didn't realise how utterly depressing this would be when it came to writing it up, because essentially I sat there for 3 months killing people off, and it was horrible, and I ate a lot of kettle chips and chocolate fingers. My friend had to buy me a cat for the George V book so I could have a kitten to play with, because he was like, oh, you're not writing another book, are you? First of all, we picked stories. Everybody who researches World War One and who does battlefield tours has picked up stories that they like or heard references to stories. So I had Etonians that I couldn't use in the Eton book, and we had Chelsea story. We had a couple from the Chelsea book where we were like, oh, we'd love to get him in. Let's do that. So we ended up with a semi-populated list of dates, and then we had to fill it in with everything else. We really didn't want repetition. So we did things like for the 16th of September, I say everybody knows, but it's well known that Raymond Asquith died on the 16th of September, so the Prime Minister's son is killed. It's not really known that the leader of the Labour Party, who was also the first Labour Party cabinet minister, his son also died on the same day, and Holmes, my co-author, being a raging lefty, was like, we have to get him in, so he's gone in as well. So we had a partially populated list of favourites to tell this battle story with. But then once that was quite fun, putting that together. And then I drove them absolutely mad with a spreadsheet called Speckled Jim, after the pigeon in Blackadder, in which we made sure that we completely had every dominion, every region of the UK, every class covered. And the whole battlefield as well. We didn't want to get to the end of writing the book and realise that we'd told a load of stories from the southern end of the battlefield and completely forgotten about what was happening up top. So I masterminded this spreadsheet, and they still hate me for it. Officers to men, we said we'd never go over more than one-third officers, because it's a lot easier to research the officers, because their files tend to exist, whereas all of the other ranks, the Germans bombed the service files in World War II, so there's only like 1 in 8 survive. So it'd be an easy way out to just cover officers, so we limited ourselves. We said at least 2/3 of them have got to be other ranks, otherwise it's just becoming elitist. Also, as well, as I said before, all regions as well, so we had a map of the UK. My geography before this book was basically everything north of the border was like north of the wall in Game of Thrones to me. I had no idea. I was like, cider comes from down there and there's some northerners up there. But we had to really get into the communities and the depth of geography in the UK to make sure that we had enough Scottish stories, that we were representing the North East, that the Welsh were in there as well. And there's certain, so you have to do the Welsh. You could not do them for Mammoth's Wood because that is the seminal battle of the First World War for the Welsh. So if we'd have not covered Wales for that, we would have been idiots and we would have been rightly panned for it. Dominions as well. So this was, they went in quite early because it's difficult because the Australians don't, they arrive at the end of July and the Canadians don't arrive till much later. So you've got limited windows to put your Dominion representatives in. So we had to do them. And then you get to the end. And I think by the time we got to the end, we had six gaps left. And what would happen was this really morbid X Factor scenario. So we would go, right, we'll meet up on Saturday and we will have got everybody for the rest of September sorted out. So we'd have a rough idea of where on the battlefield we wanted to take them from, and we'd know what battalions they were in, and we'd say, right, go out there and dig, get on Ancestry, get on the internet, see who you can find, and then we'll convene and we'll have this X Factor style thing where everybody argues the case for the guy they've got in front of them. Becomes very morbid and quite the black humour is not the word for picking it, but you get there in the end. And I think the last entry to go on the list of 141, I think he only went on about 4 weeks before we went to print, and it was a Canadian, and we had three Canadians left on Andrew Holmes's dining room table, and they were all immigrants, so they'd all left Britain to go to Canada. They were all roughly the same age, they all had roughly the same background. And it was just, I cannot take the responsibility at this late hour for telling two of these guys, no, you're not in it. So we deferred to, just going through some, so we got allies as well, different calls to make sure we had engineers and airmen and a woman, like I said. And then for the absolute, I'll just go through this quickly. The most demanding one that I did was the 1st of July, because having said we're not going to defer to the 1st of July, we're going to be really cool and make sure that we cover the whole battle, I then gave them a horrible checklist for picking the 1st of July guy. We had one shot at setting the tone for the whole book, so it had to be someone really good. They had to look good. We had to have a high-quality photo of them. Had to be a Kitchener volunteer. Had to epitomise those boys going over the top. Those 19, 14, 15 volunteers who'd rushed to serve, going over the top at the Somme. Lost generation, so we were erring towards a younger person as well. High quality photo. Part of the battlefield that epitomised the 1st of July, so a really horrible one, basically, where they suffered really heavy casualties. And then I threw another curveball at them and said it had to be in the second wave, because what I wanted to do was tell the story broadly of everybody going over at 7:30 and then zoom in on somewhere. And we spent 3 weeks arguing, hanging up on each other, screaming at each other and moaning about not being able to find someone decent before one of the Chelsea fans that we worked with for the other book went, "Will you have a look at my great uncle? His name was Billy." Instant, yes, he's in. So he was serving with the Cambridge pals, if you like, but they're in the Suffolk regiment. Second over, great photo, great story. Had the family instantly there with all of the material. So after all that moaning, it was sitting with us the whole time. And then when I said that we deferred on the Canadians, we let Jabba choose. This is Andrew's cat. So what we did was put each Canadian on the kitchen floor with a few dreamies, and whichever one Jabba went and picked on, that was it. So there's a young man called Donald O'Connor in the book who emigrated from Inverness to Canada, and he's in the book because of Jabba. So yeah. So basically we completely were not willing to take the responsibility for leaving two guys out, so we let the cat do it. He then ate the service file. So then we finished the Somme book and we thought, oh, finally, we can have a life back. Andrew and Johnny, their wives think, thank God for that. And then this place happened again. And we thought, why don't we do a Passchendaele one as well? So this is the one that's coming out in a couple of weeks. It's on the way from the printers now. And this one threw up new things and interesting new points about how we'd get to cover individual stories and remember these people that fought. there's less continuity in the third Battle of Ypres at Passchendaele. So whereas for the Somme, you could start on day one and do one a day all the way through. If you did that with Passchendaele, you'd have six boring weeks in the middle where everybody was training or waiting to do something. So we couldn't do that. So we needed to think about how we would organise our stories and where we'd take them from. I have no idea what that means, early ideas. I think Holmes put there. We were concentrating on characters. So what we did was we took a family who served from Australia all the way through the battle. So at the start of the battle, there were five of these cousins, so two sets of brothers, serving together in two battalions of the Australians. And they kept coming up throughout the battle. So what we did was we decided it'd be really nice to have a recurring story going through this one. So we've got that. And what we've done is instead of doing one on every day, we've bunched them to the days when the most important things are happening. We still have those sort of those horrible attritional deaths that happen to people while they're just minding their own business in the trenches or manning the line, but they're very much bunched so that we can tell. So for instance, when the whole battle resumes on the 20th September 1917, we make sure that we're all over the battlefield as opposed to just picking one story and doing it. So it was a lot more flexible. And also there's a couple of survivors as well, which meant there were far less chocolate fingers consumed writing this one. Yeah, less death. The Somme book's working title was The Book of Death. We found a German, which we didn't manage to do for the Somme book because just we ran out of time and we're not that good at researching the German side of things. But actually, we found a German for Passchendaele, which we're really excited about. And actually, what happened is so the Germans decided to attack on the 4th of October, and so did the Australians. And they both attacked at the same time, bumped into each other in no man's land, and went, "Oh, what's going on here?" They said they were like rising out of the mist and they had no idea, and everybody was sort of milling around going, "Am I supposed to be fighting you or are you fighting us?" And it was chaos. So what we did was take one from each side. And actually the German that we found is taken prisoner while he's wounded, and he was actually treated, and it was British doctors that tried to save his life, but unfortunately he died of his wound. So he's actually buried in a British cemetery. Finding anomalies and trends as well. So this is stuff like, so it sounds like we're experts on the battle as soon as we started and we knew all of the things going on and all of the trends emerging. This is a lie. Some of it happens just by accident. So we were looking at the 6-week break in the middle of the Battle of Passchendaele, and we were thinking, we need to tell the story of what's happening in this. I know that they're training and I know they're getting ready, but obviously people are still dying every single day. So how is this happening? So what we did was go onto Commonwealth War Graves and generate spreadsheets, which you can do from the search facility, of deaths on a certain day or a certain range of days. And we found a whole list of men from a battalion dying on the same day, which isn't strange, but it is strange if they're not even in Belgium anymore and they're all the way behind the lines. So we thought something funny's happened. And it turned out that the story is, these guys had survived the opening of the Battle of Passchendaele. They'd then half drowned in the mud. They'd been taken out for a couple of days. Then they'd been sent back in again, taken out again, sent back in again. And then finally they got on trains and they went just over the border into France to stay for some rest and recuperation. They arrived in the region of this farm in like rural France, and suddenly the farmer decided that he absolutely didn't want soldiers on his land. He said he'd had them before and they'd ruined his crop, so he wasn't going to let them billet in his field. So this huge argument ensued, and in the end the farmer said that they could stay, but only if they limited their spread to one little corner of his field. So that's what they did. One of the trends that emerges during the Battle of Passchendaele during 1917 is aerial bombardments behind the lines. So in 1916, in the Battle of the Somme, once you come out of the lines and you go to the rear, you're reasonably safe. But by 1917, the Germans are sending bombers over and bombing collections of troops, and they bombed this field and they were all bunched together because of the farmer, and more than 100 of them were wounded and 40 of them died. So we discovered this purely by accident, but it was a way to tell the story of how aerial warfare is developing in 1917. So these poor guys, and the ultimate irony is that they buried them in the corner of this field. So having kicked off, sorry, I can't think of another way to say that isn't common, having kicked off about having them in his field, they ended up there until about 1921, 22, when they were moved into one of the Commonwealth War Grave Cemeteries, where they are now. But we found the families of a few of them as well. So, and then they're all other ranks, and they're all, I think none of their families, when we spoke to them, knew what had happened. They just assumed they'd died in battle. And actually, there's, so the family of the guy on the left were actually really quite angry, and I don't blame them really, but so to think all the way through the last 100 years, his family have think he's died in battle, or that's the story that's been handed down, when actually it was a complete waste. And it was behind the lines after he'd got out of that hell at Passchendaele. One thing we really want to do as well, and I think it's really important, if you want people to understand the human impact of the war and to feel some attachment to it, this whole centenary aspect, you have to feel, you can't just stop in 1917 when they die. You have to bring it through the 100 years and show what you can see now and why it's important now and what this means to us now. So when we decided we wanted to do these books for the centenary specifically, we wanted to tell the story of each man to the end. So with most of them, and this is something that people didn't realize, a lot of people that have read the Somme said to us they didn't realize that so many people were dug up after the war and put into the cemeteries that they're in now. So when you go to France and Belgium and you look at all of the beautiful cemeteries, there was nothing like that after the war. They were scattered everywhere. And then so we've got stories of guys who were or they fell on the battlefield and then they were discovered during a cleanup operation in the 20s, and then they were exhumed and put into a cemetery. So we wanted to make sure that we followed that. We didn't want to end with their deaths. We wanted to take them all the way to where they've ended up. What we wanted to do, actually, to be fair, this is Andrew Holmes's, to his credit, he said that he wanted people to pick up this book and be able to go to the battlefield with it. So if you know nothing about the Somme and nothing about Passchendaele, doesn't matter, because this book will generally tell you what happened in the battle, tell you some interesting stories, and then you can go and visit the people in it. And what this ended up as, this is why something else on Speckled Jim, they couldn't all be on memorials for a very good reason. There had to be at least half of them had to have a grave, a tangible place you could visit for this aspect. Is this map that Andrew put together in the back of the book, so that if you do take it to the battlefield, it tells you where each of the people are buried, so that you can go and see them. And it was quite overwhelming to see that one guy actually did it. And I said this in another talk, and he was in the crowd as well. He's like a groupie. But yes, Sam went out there, and this is him visiting. He said he got to about 10 or 15 of them going around the battlefield. So that was really heartening as well, because that's what we intended when we started it. So now he feels some connection to the guys in the book as well. This means photography as well, so that people, because it's really hard if you've never been to the battlefield and you're driving across the Somme and you just see a wood and a field, and it doesn't mean anything that correlates to what you've read in a book about Mamet's Wood or what that field means. Andrew is a terrific photographer. him lying down and doing his crouch thing. Jonathan's nickname became Folder Boy, because this is when you print out the maps of the cemeteries and Andrew would mark the graves. So when we got there, it was up to Johnny to find them. And then we went about doing modern photography to go in the book as well, so that it really was something for the centenary for people to keep. So we've got headstone pictures, but we didn't want just to have pictures of headstones, because that could get really repetitive across the face of a book. So full cemetery photos as well, so people can see the surroundings, because not everybody can go to the battlefield, so they can see how these men have ended up and how they lie now 100 years on. This is the only one I got in the book. This is my photo. This is Delville Wood from Bazantine Ridge. Highwood. Oh, someone's going to pick me up on that. It's Highwood from Bazantine Ridge, so that if people park at that cemetery where this is taken and look across, they can see this is the exact way that the New Zealanders were going in September across this bit of land. So it actually means something to you if you're there, as opposed to just being completely having your mind blown by all of these cemeteries and everything that's going on around you. And this one, this took half an hour because he just wasn't happy. He can be a bit of a diva when it comes to taking the perfect shot with his camera. This is, we spend quite a lot of time in the book talking about Caterpillar Valley and how it was full of guns and how for the whole of the Battle of the Somme, it was completely targeted by German artillery trying to take out our artillery. And he did a panorama to show the whole of Caterpillar Valley, and we had to wait for the right cloud action and the right light, and then he didn't like it, and then he realised he left the memory card in the car, and it took quite a while. This is just... does anybody here go to the battlefields? So you know when you go to the battlefield and you've gone all the way from England and all the way across rural France where there's no toilets, and if you're a girl, you can't just go behind a tree, and you finally found your cemetery and you finally found your man and you want a photo, and you get the unsightly bush. Commonwealth War Graves have put a massive bush in front of the man's headstone. That was one of ours. He's in the book, but I think we actually managed to hold it back long enough to get the photo. With the Somme book, we range so far between actually meeting families. So this man is on the cover, and he's on the cover because we were fortunate enough to meet his great-grandson, who had literally everything. We've held in our hands the hairbrushes that he had in the trenches with him, other things like this as well. This is his trench cup, so it collapses and comes back up, and they had everything. Everything that got sent back in a box, they have the box, and it was mind-blowing. And so to know him, as well as knowing his wife as well, and knowing all about her, this man, his family owned a huge factory, a linen factory in Northern Ireland, that supplied all the tablecloths and bedding and things for the Cunard line and the White Star line. So it was huge, and they employed most of the men in the local area. And I've held in my hands, he's got this notebook that he kept the whole way through the battle, working up to the Battle of the Somme, of every man who worked for him and how they were doing and whether they'd been wounded or whether they'd been sick. And he was keeping an eye, because there were two brothers in the family, and the elder one stayed to be director of the company, and the younger one, Oswald, went. So he was still looking after his employees, and he was watching out for every one of them. But probably the most heartbreaking thing that we found in doing the Somme book, this is his son Patrick, is the letter that he sat and wrote in the trenches the night before they went over the top on the 1st of July. And at the end of the letter, he just says, "Be a good boy for your mummy, and I'll be back soon, and I love you." And he was actually mortally wounded on the 1st of July, and he dies on the 3rd. And he's got the longest entry in the book for obvious reasons, because there's just so much to say about him. But then at the total other end of the spectrum, a lot of the time when you're trying, because of the burnt records, you find when you're trying to research a First World War soldier, sometimes all you can say is this man was born, he joined the army, he was with this battalion that was here on this day, and he died, and no one knows what happened to him. And you can maybe get 200 words out of him. And we didn't want to leave those men out as well. So that's why when you read the book, you'll find some really quite brief entries that just literally tell you a tiny bit about the man's background, how he came to be in the army, what his battalion was doing and why, and it'll tell you how he died. And that's the reason those are in there. So this was the other end of the scale, when you find a family and they know nothing, and you're the one breaking their hearts by telling them everything that happened to their relative. So we found the nephew of this young man who died in Trones Wood, which was a disaster in July during the Battle of the Somme, in that they were told to go in the middle of the night and capture it, ready for a battle the next day, and it was never going to happen. And after the war, He was down as missing, and his father said all he wanted was to know that they'd found his boy before he died. And he actually lay out in Trones Wood for 13 years, till 1929, until he was recovered, because that's how long it took to clear the bodies and the debris out of Trones Wood. And then he was found. So we had because of Commonwealth War Graves, someone had written down the trench map coordinates of exactly where he was found. So we decided to go on a mission, an hour-long mission, trekking through Trones Wood with a GPS thing to find him. And actually, that spot in front of where the camera's taken is where he lay for 13 years. And that's his grave now in Delver Wood Cemetery. So Delver Wood Cemetery is, no one was originally buried there. It's just a massive concentration cemetery where they brought people in after the war. But his nephew burst into tears and sobbed on the phone when he found out that we'd been to the exact spot where that he'd lay. And actually, so everything we found out that he was killed trying to carry an officer to safety. He had the guy over his back and he was trying to pull him to safety. And they didn't know that either. So everything we were telling them was new and heartbreaking. So there's the two different ends of the spectrum when you're researching, is that sometimes the family gives you everything and sometimes you're actually helping them make peace with what happened. So this is my... I decided, because I only want to write about the human experience of a war. I'm not interested in doing battle histories. And I thought, what an amazing book this would be, because this is a completely unique experience of World War One, is the role of George V. Because everywhere I go and everything I do, I find people talking about him visiting them or seeing him somewhere or something that the king's done. And I thought, it really sounds like he didn't stop. So I decided that I would apply to the Royal Archives to write a book about George V just during the First World War years, thinking I'd never hear back or they'd go, no. And actually what happens is when you ask to research a senior royal, your request goes all the way up to the Queen and her private secretary. And after about 4 months, I got a letter saying yes. Then I realised, oh my God, I'm actually going to have to write this book now. Because this is for me is totally out of my comfort zone because there's politics involved in it. There's all the, I suppose the fun bit is David Lloyd George and how they didn't like each other, which is quite amusing to do. I think actually sometimes it's overblown. I think the king tries to be as nice as he can to him, but sometimes he really deserves to be shouted at. I just found the other day a 13-page write-up by the king's private secretary about a meeting he had with Lloyd George and some of the stuff he's saying about the generals, because Stamfordham was just writing down verbatim what was coming out of his mouth. And it sounds like after a very long day and a couple of whiskies, Lloyd George had rolled up at Buckingham Palace and started ranting. And the stuff he's saying, I was punching the desk. And then there's the military side of it. So there's his politics. So the thing about George V in World War One is he never has a moment off. Every possible disaster is in front of him, every possible failure, every worry, every anxiety, for everything down to how we're going to pay for the war, to how many troops we have and how we're not recruiting enough. And he was a worrier by nature. So this is the toughest few years of his life. Military wise, he took very seriously, and I think the Queen does as well, this idea that you are de facto head of the armed forces and it's your army and your navy, took it really seriously and always wanted to be visible. He's not safe when he's going out to see them. So they start off by this safe little trip in 1914. 1915, he almost dies because Douglas Haig gives him a horse that throws him off and sits on him. And he's got a broken pelvis and he was never the same again after that. 16, Queen Mary's got him restrained a bit, but he's walking the battlefield of the Somme just after some of these places have been taken. 17, she's going with him, she's not having it, so she goes out there as well. And so while he and she as well is an amazing woman, and she doesn't get nearly enough credit for what a massive heart she had. So she does base hospitals and things on the coast while he's doing the battlefield further up within shell range and everything. 18, when everything nearly goes wrong in March and the Germans start their offensive, he goes out there in the middle of it, and he's standing there in a casualty clearing station that's got dressing stations from further forward evacuating back, and there's blood up the walls and everywhere, and he's literally grabbing men by the hand and pulling them like to him as they've come out from running for like 3-4 days from the Germans and stuff. So he definitely he got as close to danger as he could. And I never thought I'd get such an education on the home front either, because he goes everywhere. He sees everything. He goes to hospitals. I know more about hospitals in World War One in the London area than I ever thought I would, like capacities, specialisations, and then it's the same for manufacturing as well. I mean, the cabinet rolled him out in 1917 to try and stop strikes happening because there was so much industrial unrest. So he really, 1917 is the worst year of his life, and he's going to be half the book at this rate because I can't edit down all the awful stuff he saw and did in 1917. And it really is the blueprint to the modern monarchy as well. So Queen Victoria, well, Prince Albert started it, getting out there and meeting people and seeing people. And he took it to a whole new level and gave the monarchy a blueprint to take forward into the 20th century properly. And that credit lies entirely with him. And the Queen is so much in his image. When you read about what he does and how he acts and that, she gets it from her father, who got it from his father, which is George V. We don't mention Edward VIII. And everybody asked me about Nicholas II. And yeah, I've found quite a lot of stuff that I've never seen in print before. I have an inkling of escape attempt, but I can't talk about it yet because the material belongs to the Royal Archives. They haven't held anything back, and it's going to take some piecing together, but it definitely looks like the royal family was at least trying to get involved in getting the Empress and the children out when they heard that Nicholas had been murdered, because they didn't know straight away that the whole family was executed together. I need to stop waffling now. But he went on a pilgrimage, and that's just something that we've been doing, is following in his footsteps and going, taking photos. So this is just one moment of George V. He went on a pilgrimage in 1922, and it was a private pilgrimage. The lengths they went to not let the French know that they were coming, because there'd have to be a band and a meeting with the president, and he didn't want to do any of it, are hilarious in the Royal Archives. He's basically incognito running around their country and hoping they don't find him. But he had a letter put in his hands from a woman who asked if Queen Mary would put forget-me-nots on her son's grave. And Queen Mary wasn't at this cemetery, but this is the kind of thing that he did frequently. So that's the king putting the forget-me-nots on her son's grave for her. I'll just click through this. This is where we've been retracing his steps on his pilgrimage and seeing how the cemeteries have gone. So this one, I nearly killed myself taking this. I had to scale a 20-foot wall. And I'll just leave you with that. That's a quote from George V, and I find it really poignant and really sad, because actually you'd think that that would have been a warning not to go to war again. But actually, 3 years after he died, we did. So he said, in the course of my pilgrimage, I have many times asked myself whether there can be more potent advocates of peace upon earth through the years to come than this massed multitude of silent witnesses to the desolation of war.
Well, that's it for today. But there's plenty more for you to enjoy at cvhf.org.uk or wherever you get your podcasts. Thank you for listening.